First thing I want to do is a little visual aid. Do you think I could get a volunteer from the audience? Would you like to help me? Yeah, would you come up here a second? Give her a hand.
Yes.
Thank you for being... Thank you for being brave. Just stay right there. And hold on to the other end of this cord, would you? Now, nothing up my sleeves. Have you ever seen how it is a string vibrates? Talk about music. Have you ever seen how the piano works? You know, there's a string in there, and there's a felt pad that when you push the key down lifts off the string, and a hammer swats the string, and it vibrates. And then when you let go of the key, that felt pad comes back down and stops the string. So it vibrates as long as you hold the key down, right? Well, when it vibrates to such a degree that you can't actually see what goes on. It's so fast, your eye can't pick it up, usually. So what I've done is and I want to show you that. I want to show you exactly how it is that things vibrate in the creation that God has made. Because this is a principle that applies to every section of his creation. So what I've got here is a telephone cord that I'm going to use as an example, because it can vibrate the way those strings vibrate, but at such a slow speed that you can actually see what goes on. Let me show you. This is something that the Greeks understood, grasped and understood, and set forth into Western civilization. I just want to give you a little Greek history here. When I vibrate this string, when the string vibrates at that speed, your physics professors would tell you that there is a node at either end and what they call an antinode in the middle, because the greatest amplitude of this wave is at the very center. It's moving not at all at her end, right? And it's moving almost not at all at my end because I'm giving it some impulse. But it vibrates like that. Now what I want you to do is take a look at what happens to this string. Can you all see back there? You can't. Can you see it? Okay, can you see over here? You can't really. Let's step back a little further. Maybe we can show it a little better this way. When I vibrate this string at this frequency, this speed, which is the frequency, it vibrates the way you see. But it changes when I change the frequency. If I increase the speed of my hand vibrating here, something weird will happen. Watch. All I'm going to do, I'm going at about 1 and 2 and 1 and 2 and about that fast. Let's see if I can get it back again. There we go. 1 and 2 and 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, how about that? 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, like that. I'm going to just speed up so that my hand will start going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, like that. All right? Watch what happens to the string. Here we go. 1, 1, 2, 1, 2. Now I'm going to start speeding up. What happened? It died. It stopped, right? It was going along just fine. And as I sped up, it stopped. Well, check it out. Watch what happens when I start it up again. I'm going to go through that chaotic point and faster and faster. Watch what happens. Now I start speeding up, and it'll stop and get chaotic. And as I get faster and faster, it goes to that. Isn't that weird? Well, let's see if I can go a little faster. A little faster, there's chaos for a minute, and then there's three of them. And then, let's see. There's four. Is that five? That's five now. Cool, huh? There's six. Now, thank you. You did a great job. Thank you very much. Now, what happens to a string? Those of you who know something about musical instruments, what happens to a string if at the same tension I make the string shorter? Makes the pitch go up, doesn't it? Right? The longer the string, the lower the pitch. The shorter the string, the higher the pitch. Right? So, that string vibrating not only at its full length like that, but at half the length and a third of the length and a fourth of the length and a fifth of the length, is actually, if you could, if, you know, this is vibrating so slowly you can see it, but you can't hear it. It actually is generating a frequency, but that frequency is so low your ear can't pick it up. The opposite is true in the piano. The frequency is so high that your eye can't pick it up, but your ears do. It sounds like this. It's vibrating so fast you actually can hear it. Well, imagine, will you, if you will, that whole length of the string being this low C. Okay? If I were to vibrate the whole length of that string, I get that pitch, okay? Now, if I were to find the frequency of exactly half the length of that string at the same tension, it would generate a pitch that's higher, wouldn't it? But how much higher? Well, it turns out it's a very exact much higher. It's one octave higher. It's that pitch. And it doesn't make a difference what pitch you start with. If you take half of it, at the same, it's vibrating at the same, the double the frequency, or half the length, you get an octave. The lowest note and an octave higher. Well, if you find the third of the length of the string, you get a pitch that is exactly a fifth higher than that note. And if a fourth of the length of the string is exactly twice as much as a half the string, so it's another octave above that note there. So now the original string is that, so half the string, a third of the string rather, and a fourth of the string are those pitches together. Now, what about a fifth of the string? Because I got all the way up to six, you remember? One, two, three, four. A fifth of the string turns out to generate that note. And a sixth of the string is twice a third of the string, so it's an octave above this one, or that note. So, that's the sound you actually get out of a single string. Because that single string generates its fundamental, they call it, and its overtones. Those notes. That's the way God made things to vibrate. Do you hear how consonant that sounds to your ears? The pitches that are above this fundamental that I played, that is what we call a C chord or a C triad above that fundamental C. In other words, all these notes are encompassed in that note. They're already there. Now, you may not believe me, so I've got a little experiment I can show you to prove it. First of all, if you listen very carefully, this is a lovely piano, and it's pretty well in tune. Yeah, pretty well in tune. It should generate such a rich sound that you, with your ears, if you listen carefully enough, will hear all these upper pitches in that. Listen really carefully. You have to be very quiet, okay? Listen. Can you hear them in there? Listen for this note. This one's pretty loud. Hear that note? Listen for that in the low note. I'm just playing the low note now. Can you hear it? It's there. Is that weird? Have you ever noticed that before? Listen for this note. It's there. Can you hear it? Now, just to prove that I'm not making this up, you know, if you press down these keys, you get those strings vibrating. But if you press them down quietly, like that, I'm holding them down now, but I didn't let the hammer strike the strings. I've just lifted the felt off the strings so that they can vibrate freely. What I'm going to do is play that low note and let go of it. And what you ought to hear is the sympathetic vibrations of all these upper pitches in that low note. If these are in that, then these will be heard in a sort of sympathetic way when I let go of the low note. So now you'll really hear it. Listen carefully for that. Okay? I'm just going to push them down. Now listen.
You hear them? There they are.
Now, just to be sure, let's do this scientifically, just to show that it doesn't actually make all the pitches of the piano vibrate, I'm going to choose these pitches. Let's say those. And I argue those are not in that. It's great to talk without nouns, isn't it? So what I'm going to do is ask you to listen to the ghost of this after I let go of that note. Okay, here we go. Silence. You hear that? Nothing. Now just slide down a half a step, play the exact same intervals, but a half a step lower, the ones that are in the chord. And there they all are. Is that amazing? My point in trying to show you this is not just a cute trick. It's that our system of music, chords and everything, are based on this physical property that God built into the creation of the world. The piano is built the way it is, the violin is built the way it is, the guitar is built the way it is, and all of the wind instruments follow the same principles, only using columns of air instead of strings. They're all built the way they are in order to take advantage of the fact that things vibrate the way they do in the creation. They're built on the way God built things. So music and what we call tonality are actually rooted in the creation. Now the reason I say that is that God built things to be consonant. Things vibrate and generate overtones, and if I play notes that are in consonant with those overtones, then you sense by your ears consonants. But if I pick a note that's not in that one and play it against that one, like these, for example, your ears go, ugh. Right? Now, what I don't want you to do is think, oh, dissonance is evil and consonance is good. That's not what I mean. But there's a system of the world vibrating that the conductor, or the composer rather, can take advantage of. So that when he writes music, when he writes his music, it goes back and forth between dissonance and consonance. Music is all about tension, the tension of dissonance, and the resolution of that dissonance. That's what happens in music. The great composers are the ones that can show you at key moments why a certain dissonance is important. I mean, if he's setting a text that calls for a certain pain or something, then he can mirror that pain actually in the choice of notes that he plays in the piece, you see? If he wants to show at the end of a phrase a certain unresolved dissonance, he has the tools to do it because he has built into the system a sort of consonance versus dissonance connection, relationship. So music actually has those qualities or characteristics because of the fact that God actually made the world the way it is. Now, a lot of people want to say, music is objectively good and bad, good or bad, based on things like dissonance or things like rock beats or things like that. And I can't bring myself to say that. Music is a language. Music is a means of communication. It can be abused in the same way that any language can be abused. I could say things to you using language right now that would shock or annoy or injure you. I can say things that will be helpful to you or that are true or good or beautiful. Same thing in music. You can use music to convey things that are worthwhile. You can use music to convey things that are not worthwhile. So music is a language. So the rhythm of something isn't inherently good or evil. But it's possible for you to speak with that language in ways that you can't speak through words. So always understand that the composer is speaking to you, and this applies to all the arts, but I'm dealing with music today. The composer is always speaking to you something. If the composer says to you, no, I'm not trying to say anything, well, I think you can challenge him on it. I think you can say, why do you spend so much time working so hard to tell me that you're not saying anything? You can say, the fact that you're trying to say nothing is itself a statement. You know what I mean? So music is a way of communication. Well, what I want to do is, this by the way, this whole understanding of fundamentals and overtones and all that came from the Greeks. It's a very old idea. And even as late as Anton Bruckner, who was a 19th century composer, loved and appreciated these overtones so much that one time he was found sitting at the piano listening to these D flats. Just over and over again. And people came to him and said, hey, Anton, what are you doing? And he said, I'm listening to the angels singing. Can you hear all those overtones singing? They're all in there. All that out of one pitch. It's amazing how God created things. Well, what I want to do is take you through a rather quick whirlwind tour of history. And to begin it, I have to speak to you about the Greeks, as I've just been talking about. The earliest written examples we have of music come from the Greeks, and they come from the temples, in particular, of two Greek gods. And those gods are Apollo and Dionysus. Now, their music was improvised on two different instruments, respectively the lyre, which is a precursor to the harp, and which is used in Apollonian worship, and the aulos, which is the precursor to the flute. You've seen a pan flute, has a reed flute that has a short reed tied to a longer reed and a longer reed like that, and you play it up and down like this. Well, that's an aulos, and it was used in the worship of Dionysus. Now, Apollo was the god of light, not light of the sun, but metaphorical light, the light of reason, the light of revelation, the light of understanding, the light of truth, that sort of understanding. And the music that's associated with Apollonian worship was generally calm, quiet, meditative, contemplative, reasonable, if you will, head-oriented. The metaphor of the light from beauty and prophecy implies a source of light to the Greeks, and that source is understood to be beyond men. So that's where you can contemplate beauty in a sort of cerebral way. Dionysus, on the other hand, was the god of nature, and specifically of vines and growing things, and so he becomes the god of wine in particular. The Roman equivalent of Dionysus was Bacchus, from whom we get the name Bacchanalia. Well, worship in the temple of Dionysus was generally orgiastic and active, and the worshippers would dance furiously, and they were believed to be willing to use drugs to alter their states of consciousness. And of course, there was sexual activity. You remember reading in the New Testament about sexual temple prostitution. Well, often that was Dionysian temple prostitution. Well, that was all a part of the worship service in the Dionysian temple. In fact, I'd like to say that the only difference really between Dionysian temple worship and the modern-day secular university is that the ancient the Dionysians could still read Greek. rock and roll and drugs and all that stuff, and it's really about the same. By the way, Dionysian worship is credited with the poetic form of what they call the dithyramb, which is the forebearer of the play, and so Dionysus becomes the god of theater, just for your information. Now, the point is, I bring these two guys up because they actually represent sort of opposing views of aesthetics. The Apollonian side can be related or described by the words head, reason, order, symmetry, balance, meditation, reflection, peacefulness, ideals, that sort of thing. Dionysian worship and the music that comes from Dionysian temple worship can be described in a sense with the opposites of those words. Heart, emotions, experience, instead of head, heart, instead of mind, emotions, instead of reason, feelings, or experience, instead of ideals, particulars. You may have seen the famous Raphael painting of the School of Athens, where you have in the center of this big arch, this beautifully symmetrical painting, you have Plato standing there with his finger pointing up like this, referring to ideals. And right next to him, the younger Aristotle, with his hand out like this, dealing with particulars. And so the two sides of this Greek mind sort of are held in that one painting. Now, the reason all this is worth mentioning is not just that I'm interested in your getting hold of Greek theory about aesthetics, but that the world has been influenced greatly by those two ever since. In fact, I would argue that those two have been maybe the most influential aesthetical principles or patterns in the history of the world. Now, the modern world, so what we call the modern world, say from the Italian Renaissance onward, 1400 to today, can be understood in a very general way as a sort of continuum on which this pendulum goes back and forth. That is, in the early part of the Italian Renaissance, the 15th century Italian Renaissance, there was a rebirth, a renaissance of Greek thinking, and in particular Apollonian Greek thinking with regard to aesthetics. If you've ever seen Hellenic sculpture, you know how they stand. Have you ever seen the sculpture? Have you ever studied art history? Any of you spent time with that? You ever see those great sculptures that where a guy is standing with all of his weight on one foot and the other foot is bent like this, and he's just standing there like this? Well, that's Hellenic style 4th century classical Greek sculpture. And it's very Apollonian. It's balanced, it's reserved, it's relaxed, it's at peace with the world. If you have ever seen Michelangelo's David, that huge, tall David that he did in Rome, the stance is exactly the same, even though there's some other changes. He borrowed it from the ancient Greeks. Well, in the Hellenic period, there's a far more highly influential Dionysian inspiration, and the Dionysian deals with motion and experience and things of this world, and moment, the moment of, not the contemplation of the ideals, but the experience of the here and now. And so Hellenistic post-Alexander sculpture, you find, looks like this. You know, or throwing a javelin or something. You know what I mean? Greek guys in motion. You saw the muscles bulging. Well, you see my muscles bulging. You know what I mean? They didn't sculpt me. They sculpted them, okay? So they were after, you know, they were after the moment of, the excitement of the experience, the moment of the battle for the gladiator, the moment of the javelin for the thrower, whatever he's doing. The death of the gladiator, if you remember that sculpture. Well, in the Renaissance, you find statues just like that at the beginning of it. Toward the end of the Renaissance, the end of the 16th century in Italy and in other places, you begin to see a shift in the pendulum from a particularly Apollonian view of what's beautiful, that is, what's perfect, what's absolute, what's ideal, what's at rest, what's rational and delightful. All of it, by the way, is based much on numbers, mathematics. If you've ever spent any time thinking about the Parthenon, you know that it's ordered by number, by ratio. It's very mathematically correct. The sculptures that I was talking about have a relationship between the ratio between the size of the hand and the arm to the body, and the head to the body, and so on, are all very particularly calculated out to make a perfect human being, supposedly. Well, the pendulum swinging, that's ancient Greece. In the Renaissance, in the early part of the Renaissance, it's Apollonian. Toward the end of it, and into the, what we call the Baroque period, the pendulum swings to the Dionysian. So you find Dionysian effects in sculpture, and in painting, and in music, and so on, in the artwork of the Baroque period. Expression becomes very important. On Sunday morning, I'm going to teach a Sunday school class at the church, and I've been asked to teach, and I'm going to compare Apollonian Renaissance settings of a text in Palestrina with Baroque Dionysian settings of the same text in Bach, J.S. Bach, and show how the two are different and the theology of the two. So if you're interested, come join us. Anyway, the Baroque period becomes Dionysian. At the end of the Baroque period, in the early part of the 1700s, this 18th century, you see a shift beginning back again. It's almost as though they say, we've had enough of this heart on the sleeve, passionate expression, give us something that's ordered and balanced and clear again. And the pendulum swings back, and sure enough, by the middle part of the 18th century, we have what we call neoclassicism in painting. And it's a neoclassical, that is Greek or Roman, idea of Apollonian aesthetic. It's a return of a more Apollonian aesthetic. So in the painting of the time, in the sculpture of the time, in the music especially of the time, if you start thinking, well, let's deal with music for a second. Bach and Handel were very much Dionysian in the way they expressed the words in their music. In the classical period, in the neoclassical period of the 18th century, you find the music of Haydn and Mozart that are far more sort of reserved and objective and witty and clever and balanced and symmetrical. Nowhere near as convoluted as some of the fugues of Bach, and thick and experiential and powerful as the cantatas of Bach. In the end of the neoclassical period, with the French Revolution and on into the next period, called the Romantic period, if you remember, the pendulum swings back to the Dionysian again. And the artwork of all the work of the 19th century again becomes influenced by and inspired by a more Dionysian approach to beauty. Beauty isn't seen in perfection and balance and form. Beauty is seen in the experiences of the day, the power of individuals fighting certain battles or revolutions or standing up for what they believe in and so on. All you got to do, for example, is compare the paintings of David before the Revolution or at the Revolution with the paintings of people like Géricault and Delacroix in the 19th century. The music of Haydn and Mozart in the end of the 18th century, the music of Beethoven and Schubert and Schumann and Liszt and Wagner and people like that in the 19th century. You would think if this pendulum swing going back and forth was going to continue the beginning of the 20th century, you'd find a swing back to the more Apollonian approach to things. And sure enough, you do. There's what they call another neoclassical moment in history at the beginning part of the 20th century in the music of people like Stravinsky and Prokofiev and Eric Satie in France and even some of late Debussy's music. So you find, sure enough, there's a sort of clarification and an order and a witty, dry, rational sort of approach to music again. From that point on, in the 20th century, there are all sorts of schools that break loose, and there are reasons for that that I'm not going to go into, but the pendulum swing can be seen, I think, very clearly between the two ends of this sort of Greek mind all throughout what we call modern history. Now, that's a very general rule, understand. So it's worth applying if you've never dived into this sort of understanding of art before. But take a look at it and see how many people actually do find their understanding of what's beautiful based on one or the other of those two principles. Now, what I want to argue, and a very astute young man said to me this morning, isn't it true that the sort of subjective and objective parts of the experience of the beautiful are not either completely right or wrong? Well, yeah, that's right. I'm not here to say that the subjective is wrong. I am here to say two things. First, that there's a parallel in aesthetics between this Apollonian and Dionysian picture and the objective-subjective split that I talked about earlier today. The Apollonian deals with the things that are objective more, or at least parallel to the things that are objective, because it's dealing with things that are transcendent, beyond us, ideal in Plato's terms, that sort of thing. The Dionysian lends itself to a comparison to the subjective, the things that we feel when we come in contact with art, the things that we experience. Into this Apollonian Dionysian slash objective subjective picture that I'm trying to draw for you comes the church. Because the church, you see, is another force and form altogether. And I mentioned this morning how I thought the Trinity and the Incarnation both lend themselves to the foundation of what might be a Christian aesthetic. Well, I want to argue that the church has argued, has said all down through the ages, that Jesus himself is the solution to this problem between the Apollonian and the Dionysian. It turns out man himself is not just either rational or emotional, ideal or particular, you see. Jesus then steps into the picture and says, look, I'm it. When he said, I am the truth, he wasn't just sort of saying empty words or nice flighty things. He was speaking to a world that knew very well what he was talking about. When at the beginning of John's Gospel, John says, the Word, the Logos, became flesh and dwelt among us. He was speaking to people who understood what Logos meant. The Greeks knew that word. That was a Greek word. They used that all the time. And John came along and said, that idea you've got of the pure, perfect, transcendent mind, this Platonic sort of picture, well, you've finally seen him in the flesh. He stood here and dwelt among us. The Incarnation teaches that. Well, so when Jesus said, I am the truth, he was saying, I am, lots of things that he was saying, but one of the things he was saying was, I am the sort of manifestation of the very problem you've always had, you philosophers. I am at once the transcendent God and a particular man. I am the best that Plato ever thought of, and not the worst that Plato thought of. They're not the same, understand? And I am the best that Aristotle ever thought of, and not the worst that Aristotle ever thought of. See? Mixed into this history of Greek thinking comes the Christian church with its understanding that Jesus himself answers these questions. So, the influence of the Holy Spirit when trusting God, the influence of the indwelling Holy Spirit is a third power in the working of the historical Western world. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that the Greek picture is a falsely bifurcated picture. Man isn't just reason or emotion. You can't just decide I'm sort of for this one and against that one, or for this one and against that one. You've got to somehow see a combination of the two things. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever anybody says, you've got to find a balance, I reach for my revolver, as the joke goes. I forget, one of the Germans said that one time. Anytime I hear somebody talk about culture, I reach for my revolver. I'm not talking about that. What I'm saying is, anybody says to me, you've got to find a balance between two things like reason and emotion, I say, forget it. It's impossible. I can't find any balances. I'm no good at that. You've got to have a third way to go that you can go completely to. And God himself finds the balance between those two things. Don't rely on yourself to come up with these balances. I'm not sure I can do it. I think God intends for me to follow him, and then he brings balances between these two things. He shows us what the relationship is between our minds and our emotions and our body. The question is, what is that relationship? And I think that's the question for Christians dealing with aesthetics. What do we say? Now, the problem in our day and age is that we live in a time when the pendulum is at one end of the spectrum. And we have to somehow make up for that by incorporating what the thing that we're missing. If I were to ask you, after having laid out this pendulum swinging thing, what you think the prevailing view is in our day and age, what would you say? Emotional. Dionysian. Wouldn't you agree? All you got to do is go to a, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and you see that most of what we're about in our day and age is capturing people's emotions, making them feel things. And I want to say, this is sort of off my notes a second, but I want to say that's what happens in the church sometimes too. Because we say we want to have a worship service, but we want to have a worship service that makes people feel like they've been in the presence of God. It's possible to fool us into thinking that we've been in the presence of God because we can manipulate feelings. Don't get lost in that. In aesthetics, we talk about objective and subjective, but the bringing of those two things together is going to be the way that we can see God's hand in the midst of this whole experience of knowing and creating and appreciating beauty. Jonathan Edwards argues that the source of beauty is God Himself. I touched on this a little bit this morning. And that, he says, this beauty can be understood in two areas. First, he says, the beauty of moral virtue. And second, beauty is seen in what he calls the agreement or unity of purpose of the Godhead in the Trinity. That the Trinity Himself, Him themselves, if you want to look at it that way, has a unity and a clarity and an order and a relationship, unity of purpose and a relationship, an agreeable, agreeing relationship in the Trinity, and that that is inherently beautiful. So, he says, by analogy, there's a mutual, what he calls, quote, a mutual propensity and affection of heart in the Trinity, and then from the Trinity to those things that the Trinity creates. In other words, God loves you. He makes you, and then He extends to you that same propensity of affection that He has within the Trinity. It's an astounding gift. The order and mutual, this order mutual propensity is reflected, he says, in a secondary or an inferior kind of beauty. That's the first kind of beauty, the one of the beauty of God Himself. This inferior or the secondary beauty, Edward says, is formed not only in the relation of spiritual beings, but it's seen by analogy in inanimate things. Examples of this secondary beauty, he says, include the, quote, mutual agreement of the various sides of a square, the beautiful proportions in the various parts of the human body, and, he says later on, the sweet mutual consent and agreement of the various notes. Tune. And I'm very glad he said that. As a musician, I'm very glad he said that. Now, this important connection between the nature of God's virtuous character and the secondary beauty of created things is the way that we forge a significance for beauty of the objects in this world. Did you get that? The connection between the things of this world that are beautiful and the beauty of God Himself is significant. The external physical world is formed in analogy to the spiritual world, Edwards argues. God seems to take delight in analogy. He makes created things reflect something of the invisible qualities of His nature and the nature of the agreement among spiritual creatures. Okay, all right. Let me read you a slightly long quote from Edwards because I think it's so pithy and so worthwhile. Listen hard for a second. It pleased God, he says, quote, it pleased God to establish a law of nature by virtue of which the uniformity and mutual correspondence of a beautiful plant, the respect which the various parts of a regular building seem to have to one another, and their agreement and union and the consent or concord of the various notes in a melodious tune should appear beautiful because therein is some image of the consent of mind, the different members of a society or system of intelligent beings, sweetly united in a benevolent agreement of heart. And here I would further observe, he says, that God so constituted nature that the presenting of this inferior beauty, especially in those kinds of it which have great resemblance to the primary beauty, as in the harmony of sounds, the beauties of nature, have a tendency, he says, to assist those whose hearts are under the influence of a truly virtuous temper, to dispose them to the exercises of divine love, and enliven in them a sense of spiritual beauty. End quote. Do you hear what he's saying? Understanding and appreciating the order and the relationship and the mutual propensity of spirit in the analogous items in this world, observing that and seeing it for what it is, actually leads you to the virtues, he says, of divine love and a sense of spiritual beauty. Now, mind you, he adds this terrific little phrase to show you that art doesn't actually save your soul. He says this. He says, to those whose hearts are under the influence of a truly virtuous temper, this happens. So in other words, he's not giving up his understanding of salvation or how it is that God brings your heart to right relationship with him. He says, if your heart is already tuned this way, then when you see these things, you will begin to know more and more and more. If I could get one thing across to you this week, it's this. And I tried to say it in the first service, the first time I got together. I'm going to say it again now. Art is for this purpose. This is the purpose of art. It's not its only purpose, but it's its highest purpose. Art brings you to an appreciation for those things that you can't see. So the point is that beauty is not only a pleasant diversion, which is what it becomes in a culture that has given up God and has focused completely on the subjective. Beauty becomes a sort of diversion, an entertainment, like we talked about this morning, an amusement. But it is actually one of the ways that God reveals himself in his creation. It's not specific revelation. Don't get me wrong. I'm not placing art up there somehow equal with the Bible. I'm talking in terms of general revelation. So, in this case, if that's the case, what Christians call beautiful in this world says a lot to the watching world about who we call beautiful. And the bottom line of it, the practical application of this idea, is that things that you like, well, hang on, let me put it the other way around. Things are sometimes beautiful whether you like them or not. Things are sometimes ugly whether you like them or not. Things actually have an objective attitude about them. Now, that doesn't mean that the subjective is wrong. I'm going to argue that the subjective is an important part of what it means to be a human being. I told you earlier, we've been given the gift to be able to appreciate things and feel when we come in contact with beautiful things. So don't ever give that up. In fact, it's a mystery that I'm really reluctant to dive into and speak away about. It's a very delicate sort of flower I want to reserve and hold carefully. Mortimer Adler says that beauty is both those things that are admirable, the objective, and enjoyable, the subjective. If you find yourself relating to the beautiful one way or the other, if you find yourself in yourself thinking really in subjective terms and the objective seems very strange and foreign to you, well, you've got a lot of friends. Not only in our day and age, but I think even great philosophers have said, for example, Thomas Aquinas said, defined beauty as that which pleases upon being seen. But if you find, on the other hand, that you are swayed and moved by the objective side and you can't quite bring yourself to embrace the subjective as any good, well, the same Thomas Aquinas argues that beauty is defined as unity, proportion, and clarity. Now, how can that one guy hold two different definitions for beauty? Seems very unfair of him, doesn't it? To sort of sit on the fence like that. But it's not. You see, he understands, I think, what Edwards is talking about, what I'm trying to get across here, that the combination of the two actually is the appreciation of the beautiful. You can't let go of either one. You must hold them together. Well, that's a lot of what we think, isn't it? I really loved that song in church the other day. Ah, it made me cry. Is that how you evaluate it? I'm trying to say, don't stop evaluating it that way, only start evaluating it objectively as well. And that means in terms of three things. Performance, composition, and content. Those are the big three objective things to deal with. To evaluate those three things means you're evaluating, whether you like it or not, you're evaluating what's going on in the work and not just how you felt when you saw it. So include those in your consideration. Now, what would be great is if we could find in ourselves to learn to enjoy those things that are admirable, to use Mortimer Adler's words. To sort of tune our sensibilities of enjoyment to connect up with those things that are actually objectively beautiful too, that are admirable in and of themselves. And I think part of the result of the fall is that our sensibilities have been broken free from our understanding. And what I think this generation really needs the most is a retooling or a restructuring or recalibration sort of our sensibilities. For example, if you go to a movie, most of you probably don't do this, but a lot of folks do, go to these sort of mad slasher movies, horror movies, you know, where some insane person is carving people into little bits and so on. It's horrifying, but people go to them and laugh through them. Have you ever, you know? If you go to one of those and you find that doesn't bother you, seeing human beings murdered and abused that way, and then you go home and you turn on the TV later on or something and you come across a Hallmark card commercial where there's a little kitten in a tree in the rain, you know? Or the soldier is only 24 hours left of his leave and he's calling his mom to tell him he loves her, you know, in the rain or something. And you find in yourself a little tear forming in your eye, you know? Well, there's something wrong with you. Don't you think? Because if you can see the image of God dismembered and not be moved, something's wrong. You should be angry about that. You should be revolted about that. There's something perverse about that. If you can be moved to tears by things that are sentimental hogwash, you see, then you're off base. You're off balance. What we need to be able to do is recalibrate our emotional sensibilities, our relationships, in our emotions, to things that are genuinely worth being upset about or worth not being upset about. That's wisdom. Let me read you a few quotes from those who have supported the idea of objectivity throughout the ages. Let me start. I mentioned Edwards. Let me jump back to the Greeks for a minute and talk about Plato. For Plato, beauty in music leads to the understanding of the good. Remember, I mentioned that there were three ideas: truth, goodness, beauty. Well, Plato argued even way back then that to understand the good, you had to first understand the beautiful, that they were linked. Let me read you the quote. In Book 3 of the Republic, he says that, quote, musical training is a more potent instrument than any other because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace. Interesting. And making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful. and of him who is less educated, ungraceful. And also, because he has received this true education of the inner being, he will most shrewdly perceive omissions or faults in art and nature. And with a true taste, while he praises and rejoices over and receives into his soul good and becomes noble and good, he will justly blame and hate the bad, now in the days of his youth, even before he's able to know the reason why. And when reason comes in his teenage years and so on, he will recognize and salute the friend with whom his education has made him long familiar. That is virtue. And that reminds me of a scene from The Merchant of Venice, where Lorenzo says to Jessica in Act 5, Scene 1, "The man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as a rebus. Let no such man be trusted." Mark the music. Aristotle in his Metaphysics says that the chief forms of beauty are order, symmetry, definiteness, clarity, Thomas would say later on. And these, Aristotle says, are understood not from the arts, but from science. Augustine wrote that beauty in art and the creation reflects something of divine beauty. So even back in the 5th century, 4th and 5th century AD, we were hearing from Augustine that there's a link directly from beauty to the divine. So that's not a new idea at all. Hans Urs von Balthasar, a Catholic writer in our century, who I think is very astute in the area of aesthetics, has written that when we lose beauty, we find that truth becomes more brittle, and goodness loses its attractiveness. And I argue that's exactly what's happened. We Christians fight for truth and goodness, but we leave beauty to be relativized often. We don't fight for beauty. And the result is that the God that we put forth to the watching world is not the whole God. Without beauty, goodness loses its attractiveness. You may say, you know, I really ought to live that way, but I don't feel like it. But if it's beautiful and good, it's attractive still. Truth becomes brittle. You can, I think at one point von Balthasar says, you can still write syllogisms, but they clatter on like machines and no longer compel without beauty. Beauty is an assistant to the truth too. In other words, the three of those things are braided together. When we speak of the glory of the Lord, it is at least the three of those things together. The glory of God is His truth, His goodness, and His beauty together. Now the problem we've got in our day and age, since we've got a divided world, a sort of objective-subjective split, and we stand mostly in our culture on the subjective side, for the Christian is to try and regain the connection between the two, as I've said. Now, when we work on forging an aesthetic, we have to bring these two sides to proper relationship. And I think one of the ways to do that is to use the word taste properly. I think this is the assistant that we can call on to help us accomplish this massive job. The word taste usually means to us personal preference. But I want to say that's a spin that's come from our subjectivity about beauty. Because if you look in the OED or you look in the Merriam-Webster unabridged dictionary, you can find about fourth or fifth definition down for the word taste, something like this: the power or practice of discerning or enjoying whatever constitutes excellence. J.I. Packer and Tom Howard wrote in a book called Christianity: The True Humanism, interesting title, They said that taste is a facet of wisdom. It's the ability to distinguish what has value from what does not have value. That's what taste should mean to us. You see how it incorporates not only our subjective response, but it incorporates an understanding of what's objective about the thing too. That it's somehow outside of us. It's not only our own selves making the decisions. It's seeing what is fitting, not just what's fitting to me. There's a problem regarding the combination of the two sides, and it comes up when we make the mistake of confusing one for the other. Objective excellence and subjective enjoyment don't have a one-to-one relationship in our fallen world. Sometimes our enjoyment of a piece of music leads us to claim for it intrinsic excellence. That is, sometimes we raise to a position of admirable that which is not, only because we really like it, or it pleases us personally. This is mistaking the subjective for the objective. But the reverse is true too. We can make the opposite mistake when we insist that everyone enjoy a piece of music that has many admirable qualities. I could say, hey, this has lots of admirable qualities, and you ought to enjoy it. That's not necessarily going to happen either all the time. It's not easily one-to-one that way. So don't try and make it, okay? More profoundly, there's a problem when we embrace only the subjective side, though, and that's what I think is going on today. The difficulty with the subjective side is not in its enjoyment. We should be enjoying the beautiful. That's right and good. In fact, apart from sin, all enjoyment is a good thing, I think. Sometimes the devil would like to deny us that at every level. The problem comes when we reject the admirable as worth pursuing and erect in its place that enjoyment for its own sake is worth pursuing. See the difference? That's exchanging the objective for the subjective. So aesthetics becomes relativistic when the concept of objective beauty is discarded in favor of pure subjectivity. That is, judging by only what makes us feel good. And it happens that for some reason we seem more susceptible to that error today in the area of music. Now, if the admirable were always found enjoyable, there wouldn't be any problem. We'd always choose the admirable, even if our only criteria was the subjective. Because as soon as we felt good about it, we'd know it was good. But it doesn't work that way. You can have actually a sort of false aesthetic experience, if you will. It's possible. You can usually find a telephone company commercial on TV to bring a tear to the eye, or hear a popular song that seems so sincere. You know? I believe the children are the future. You know? Raise them up and let them lead the way. Give them all the love you have inside. Okay. Now, I don't mean that everybody who writes a piece of music like that is consciously trying to manipulate your feelings, but it can happen. It can talk you into feeling things that you, if you look at it for a minute, you go, what am I doing? Right? Okay, in conclusion, let me say this. The modernist position in aesthetics, I think, is spelled out pretty well by Kant. There's nothing that's absolute, but we can yet know beauty based on our subjective responses. And most people in our day hold that position, whether they're Christians or not. So I think Christians need to take a stand at that point and say no. That's not all there is. The pre-modern position described by Edwards has been all but forgotten in our relativistic age, and that the source of beauty is the nature of God himself. In any other area of thought, we'd be the first to hold absolutes. Why not here? Rethinking our position on beauty may seem abstract or theoretical and without practical use, but I want to argue that doing so will give us a new insight into a lot of things. Man's nature, general revelation, common grace, creativity, worship, art, the gifts that God has given the people to be salt and light in the culture, all those things will be revamped, rethought, and I think far more multifaceted if we take up this chore. We must put examples of this proper definition into place before men. Why should we design another shapeless building in which to proclaim the eternal truths of God? Why should we borrow the music of a vapid popular culture to offer our God in our worship services or proclaim His truth to the watching world through that music. Why? Can't we do better? We ought to be leading this culture, not following behind it. We need to seriously consider the question, does the artistic style convey a message? Yes, I think. And the question, are we willing to mold our sensibilities, not to mention those of our children, to the popular culture? C.S. Lewis said that we will not read nothing. If we don't read good books, we will read bad books. If we don't find delight in refined things, we'll find delight in debased things. That's the way it's going to be. We can say the same thing about music and art. We'll not view or listen to nothing. If we don't deal with good art, we'll accept bad art. If we don't have an appreciation of the beautiful, we'll settle for the mediocre. Find those who are gifted in our churches and set them to work, composing and painting and designing. God's given gifts to the church. Let's see them. Let's hear new music composed by our own congregation for the glory of God and the edification of our souls. Let's see it. Guided by spiritual leaders who are serious about working out aesthetics from a Christian worldview. In doing so, one day we might find an envious world hungry again for the rich life that we have in the church. That's not the way it is now. If we do not establish a new aesthetic for the church before a watching world, we'll have squandered much of our spiritual inheritance and missed something that God has revealed to us. In past centuries, the church has set the cultural pace for the culture. Will we regain that place? One way to do so is to rethink our approach to aesthetics based on incarnation and Edwards' thought that beauty is more than just in the eye of the beholder, it's in the heart of God. Thank you very much.